structures are more rigid, alas. The light in the dark stranger's eyes was deceptive. He smiled amiably, as if they were discussing the weather. His reliable cheerfulness tore at Sarah's heart. "Nothing can be done?" "Out in the galaxy, perhaps." It was an old expression, almost habitual, whenever one hit the limits of the crude arts available on the slope. "But we can do no more. Not in this place." There was something in the doctor's tone. All four eyes stared inward, as if a human being were studying his fingernails, waiting for someone else to say the unspoken. Sarah looked to Arianna Fu, whose face was composed. Too composed. Sarah leaped on the doctor's hanging implication. "You can't be serious." The sage briefly closed her eyes. When they reopened, there was a daring glitter.
"Word comes down that our invaders are plying mass opinion, winning converts with drugs, potions, and miracle cures. Already unsanctioned caravans of the sick and lame have set out from Tarek and other sites, hobbling up the hard trails in desperate search of remedies. I admit, the thought even crossed my mind."
She lifted her stick-thin arms from her fragile body.
"Many may die on the trek, but what matters such risk against the lure of hope?"
Sarah paused.
"Do you think the outsiders can help him?"
Arianna shrugged in the hoonish manner, with a puff of air in her cheeks.
"Who can say? Frankly, I doubt even galactics could repair such damage, but they may have palliatives to improve his lot. Anyway, all bets are off if my suspicion is true."
"What suspicion?"
"That our stranger is no poor savage at all."
Sarah stared, then blinked.
"Ifni," she breathed.
"Indeed."
Arianna Fu nodded.
"Shall we see if our guest truly was delivered to us by our goddess of luck and change?"
Sarah could barely manage a nod. While the old woman rummaged in her valise, Sarah pondered,
"This must be why everyone was in awe of her when she was chief human sage before Campbell. They say genius is a knack for seeing the obvious. Now I know it's true. How could I have been so blind?"
Arianna took up several of the sheets recently copied on Engril's machine.
"I thought of asking a sensitive to sit in, but if I am right, we'll want this kept quiet. So we'll make do by watching how he reacts. Note that he is probably the only person in Tarek Town who has not seen these yet. Everybody pay close attention, please."
She rolled closer to the patient, who watched attentively as Arianna laid a single sheet on the coverlet. His smile gradually thinned as he picked up the drawing, touching the fine, expert lines. Mountains framed a bow-like veil littered with shattered trees, nest lining for a thick javelin adorned with jutting spines, whose contours Sarah had first seen hurtling above her shaken home. Fingertips traced the sloping curves, trembling. The smile was gone, replaced by a look of agonized perplexity. Sarah sensed that he was trying to remember something. Clearly there was familiarity here, and more, much more. The stranger looked up at Arianna Fu, eyes filled with pain and questions he could not pose.
"What can this prove?"
Sarah asked, writhing inside.
"He finds the image of the ship troubling,"
Arianna answered.
"As it would any thoughtful member of the Six," Sarah pointed out.
The older woman nodded.
"I had expected a happier response."
"You think he's one of them, don't you?"
Sarah asked.
"You think he crashed into the swamp east of Dolo aboard some kind of flying machine? He's a galactic, a criminal."
"It seemed the simplest hypothesis, given the coincidence in timing. A total stranger, burned amidst a humid swamp, appearing with injuries unlike anything our doctors have seen. Let's try another one."
The next sketch showed the same little valley, but with the starship replaced by what the sages called a research station, assigned the task of analyzing Jijoan life. The stranger peered at the black cube, intrigued, and perhaps a little frightened. Finally, Arianna presented a drawing showing two figures with strong, confident faces, a pair who had come 100,000 light-years to plunder. This time, a sharp gasp escaped him. The stranger stared at the human forms, touching the symbol patches on their one-piece exploration suits. It did not require Fey sensitivity to read despair in his eyes. With an incoherent cry, he crumpled the sketch and flung it across the room, then covered his eyes with an arm.
"Interesting, very interesting," Arianna murmured.
"I fail to understand," the doctor sighed. "Does this mean he is from off Jijo or not?"
It's too soon to tell, I fear." She shook her head. "But let's say it turns out he is from the five galaxies. If the forayers are seeking a mislaid confederate, and we have him in hand to offer in trade, it might work to our advantage."
"Now just a darn—" Sarah began, but the older human only continued, thinking aloud.
"Alas, his reaction isn't one I'd call eager to be reunited with lost comrades. Do you think he might be an escaped foe? That somehow he survived imprisonment, even attempted murder, just a day or so before the foray ship came down to land? If so, how ironic his particular injury, which prevents him from telling so much. I wonder if they did it to him, the way barbaric kings of old Earth used to rip out an enemy's tongue. How horrible, if true!"
The range of possibilities rattled off by the sage left Sarah momentarily stunned. There was a long stretch of silence until the doctor spoke once more.
"Your speculations intrigue and terrify me, old friend. Yet now I must ask that you not agitate my patient further."
But Arianna Fu only shook her head in somber pondering.
"I had thought to send him up to the glade right away. Let Vubbin and the others decide for themselves what to do next."
"Indeed? I could never allow you to move one so seriously."
"Of course, an opportunity to offer him galactic-level treatment of his injuries would make a fine synergy, combining pragmatism with kindness."
The Gekek medic's oral flap opened and shut soundlessly as he worked to find a way past Ariana's logic. Finally, his stalks contracted unhappily. The retired sage sighed.
"Alas, the point seems moot. From what we've seen, I doubt very much that our guest here will be willing to go."
Sarah was about to tell the old woman where she could go with her intent to meddle in a man's life. But just then the subject of their deliberations lowered his arm. He looked at Ariana and Sarah. Then he picked up one of the sketches. He swallowed, and his brow furrowed with intense concentration. All eyes stared back at him. The man lifted one of the drawings, showing the starship nestled in a bower of shattered trees. He stabbed the scene with his index finger.
Go!
Then he looked into Sarah's eyes pleadingly. His voice dropped to a whisper.
Go.
After that, discussion of Sarah's plan seemed almost anticlimactic.
I won't be going back to Dolo on the next boat after all. I'm on my way to see the aliens. Poor father. All he ever wanted was to raise a gaggle of safe little papermakers. Now every heir goes rushing into danger's pincers just as fast as our legs can carry us.
Engril and Bloor, the portraitist, arrived, bearing portable tools of their trades. Bloor was a short, fair-skinned man with ringlets of yellow hair showering over his shoulders. His hands were stained blotchy from years creating the delicate emulsions required by his art. He held up a plate of metal as wide as his palm, which shimmered with finely etched lines and depressions. From certain angles, those acid-cut shapes coalesced to form sharp profiles of shadow and light. "It's called the Daguerre process," he explained. "Actually, it is quite a simple technique for creating permanent images, one of the first methods of photography ever invented by wolfling humans back on old Earth, or so say our reference books. We don't employ the procedure for portraits nowadays, as paper is faster and safer."
"And paper decays,"
Ariana Fu added, turning the plate over in her hands. Depicted on the etched metal was an Urish warrior of high rank, with both husbands perched on her back in a formal pose. The female's sinuous neck was painted with garish zigzag stripes, and she held a large crossbow, as if cradling a beloved scent daughter.
"Indeed," the portraitist conceded. "The fine papers produced by Sarah's father are guaranteed to corrupt in less than a century, leaving no traces to betray our descendants. This sample daguerreotype is one of only a few not sent to the Dross Midden since our strengthened commons started promoting wider respect for the law. I have special permission to hold on to this excellent example. See the fine detail? It dates from before the Third Urish Human War. The subject is a chieftain of the Sul tribes, I believe. Note the tattoo scars. Marvelous. As crisp and clear as the day it was taken."
Sarah leaned forward as Ariana passed the slim plate over.
"Has anyone used this process on Jijo since then?"
Bloor nodded.
"All members of my guild create one daguerreotype as part of our master work. Nearly all are then sent to the Midden or given to smiths for remelting, but the capability remains."
He lifted a satchel, causing a faint clinking of bottles. "There's enough acid and fixative here to treat and develop several dozen plates, but I have only about 20 of the plates themselves.
If we want more, they must be ordered from Ovoom Town or one of the volcano smithies. Sarah felt a tap on her shoulder and turned to see the stranger holding out his hand. She gave him the small photograph, and he traced the finely etched grooves with his fingertips. Now that her mind had shifted to encompass Arianna's theory, everything the wounded man did seemed to refract differently. Was he smiling now over the crudeness of this photographic technology, or expressing enchantment at its cleverness? Or was the sparkling delight in his eyes a reaction to the depicted image of a savage warrior whose bow and lance had been such a scourge during that age of heroic struggle 10 generations ago? Arianna Fu rubbed her chin.
20 plates. Let's say you get a good picture with just half.
A generous estimate, my sage, since the technique requires long exposure times. Arianna grunted.
A half dozen successes, then, and several must be handed over to the forayers in order for a threat to be believable.
Copies can be made,
Engrel put in.
We won't need copies, Sarah said. They'll have to assume we have plenty of others. The crucial point is, can these pictures last 1,000,000 years?
The portraitist blew at a strand of yellow hair. From his throat there emerged a soft, strangling sound, like a Cowan sigh.
Given the right storage conditions, this metal oxidizes a nice protective layer.
He laughed nervously, looking from Sarah to Arianna.
You aren't serious, are you? A bluff is one thing. We're desperate enough to clutch at straws. But do you really imagine you can store evidence somewhere until the next galactic survey?
The Gekek doctor twisted 2 eye stalks to stare in opposite directions.
It appears we have entered into entirely new realms of heresy.
Asks.
It may have been a mistake to have striven so hard to suppress psi powers among the six. For most of the long millennia of our exile, it seemed the wisest move. Was not our greatest goal to remain hidden? We had only to build modestly in harmony with nature, and let the inverse square law do the rest. But psi channels are fey, non-linear, or so say books printed by the humans, who admit that their kind knew little about the subject when their ancestors fled this way. When the holy egg first gave us Rauk, some among the six feared the symbionts worked by Psi, which might make our fugitive enclave more detectable. Despite satisfying proof that it is not so, that old slander has now returned, once more stirring friction among us. Some even contend that the holy egg itself may have attracted our ruin. After all, why do pirates come now, a mere century after the blessed day the egg emerged? Others point out that we might by now know much more about our invaders, if only we had bred adepts of our own, instead of the few sensitives and truth-scryers we have today. Regret is a silly, useless thing. I might as well pine for the rings our ancestors were said to have abandoned, simply because those toroids were tainted with sin. Oh, how many things the legends say those rings once let us do! To run before the wind, as fleet as any Ur's, to swim like Cowans and walk beneath the sea, to touch and handle the world at all levels of its grainy texture. Above all, to face this dire, dread-filled universe with a self-centered confidence that was utterly, biologically serene. No uncertainty to plague our complex community of selves. Only the towering egotism of a central, confident I.
Dwer. The blue Cowans of the mountains had different traditions than their cousins who lived behind mighty Dolo Dam. Molting rituals back home always seemed informal. Human youngsters from the nearby village ran free with their chitinous friends, while grown-ups shared nectar beer and celebrated the coming of age of a new generation. In this alpine sanctuary, the chants and hissing rituals felt more solemn. Guests included the local Gekek doctor, some Treiki gleaners, and a dozen human neighbors, who took turns at a warped window pane to view events in the larva creche next door. The hoons who fished the lake behind the dam had sent the usual regrets. Most hoon felt incurably squeamish toward the Cowan way of reproduction. Dwer was here out of gratitude. If not for this kindly hive, he might be flexing stumps instead of a nearly full set of fingers and toes, still tender, but recovering. The occasion also came as a break from tense preparations with Danil Ozawa. When beckoned to the window by Carving Tongue, the local matriarch, Dwer and Danil bowed to the matriarch and to the human tutor, Mr. Shedd.
"Congratulations to you both," Ozawa said. "May you have a fine clutch of graduates."
"Thank you, honored sage."
Carving Tongue's breathy sigh seemed edgy. As head female, she laid more than half the eggs. Many of the throbbing shapes next door would be her offspring, preparing to emerge at last. After waiting 20 years or more, some strain was expected. Mr. Shedd had no genetic investment in the young Cowans transforming next door, but anxiety rode across the instructor's gaunt face.
"Yes, a fine clutch. Several will make excellent senior students when their shells harden and they take names."
Carving Tongue added,
"Two are already precocious chewers of wood, though I believe our tutor refers to other talents."
Mr. Shedd nodded.
"There is a school downslope where local tribes send their brightest kids. Elmira should qualify if she makes it through."
The matriarch erupted a warning hiss.
"Tutor, keep your private nicknames to yourself. Do not jinx the larvae on this sacred day."
Mr. Shedd swallowed nervously.
"Sorry, matron."
He rocked side to side in the manner of a Cowan boy caught stealing a crayfish from the hatchery ponds. Fortunately, a Treiki caterer arrived with a cauldron of Vel nectar. Humans and Cowans crowded the table. But Dwer saw that Ozawa felt as he did. Neither of them had time for a euphoric high, not while preparing for a deadly serious mission. "Too bad, though," Dwer thought, noting how the Treiki spiked each goblet with the race-specific spray from its chem-synth ring. Soon the mood in the chamber lightened as intoxicants flowed. Carving Tongue joined the throng at the cauldron, leaving the three humans alone by the window.
"That's it, my beauties. Do it gently,"
murmured the scholar, contracted to teach Cowan children reading and math. a long, patient task, given the decades larvae spent in one muddy suite, devouring wrigglers and slowly absorbing the mental habits of sapient beings. To Dwyer's surprise, Mr. Shedd slipped a functioning rauk over his face. Lately, most of the symbionts had gone dormant or even died. Dwyer peered through the window, a rippled convex lens with a broken stem in the middle. A greasy pool filled the center of the next room, which dim shapes traversed, casting left and right as if in nervous search. Those may have been Mr. Shedd's beloved pupils a few days ago, and some would be again, after molting into adolescent Kewans. But this play harkened back millions of years to a time long before the patrons of the Kewan race meddled and reshaped them into starfarers. It had a bloody logic all its own.
"That's right, children. Do it softly."
Shed's hopeful sigh cut off with a yelp as the pond erupted in froth. Worm-like forms flipped out of the water in a thrashing tangle. Dwyer glimpsed one shape that was already nearly five-sided, with three legs flailing under a glistening carapace of aquamarine. The new shell bore livid marks of recent raking. Trailing were tatters of white tissue, the larval body mass that must be sloughed. Legend said that Kewans who still roamed the stars had ways to ease this transition, machines and artificial environments. But on Jijo, molting was much the same as when Kewans were clever animals, hunting the shallows of the world that gave them birth. Dwyer recalled running home in tears the first time he saw molting, seeking comfort and understanding from his older brother. Even then, Lark had been serious, learned, and a bit pedantic. Sapient races have many reproductive styles. Some focus all their effort on a few offspring, which are cherished from the start. Any good parent will die to save her child. Hoons and Gekeks are like humans in this so-called high-K approach. Urs breed much like fish in the sea, that's low-K, casting hordes of offspring to live wild in the bush until the survivors sniff their way back to blood relatives. Early human settlers thought the Urs way heartless, while many Urs saw our custom as paranoid and maudlin. Kewans fall in between. They care about their young, but also know that many in each clutch must die so that others can live. It's a sadness that lends poignancy to Kewan poetry. Truly, I think the wisest of them have a better grasp of life and death than any human ever could. Sometimes Lark got carried away. Still, Dwyer saw truth in what his brother said. Soon a new generation would shamble out of the humid nursery to a world that would dry their shells and make them citizens. Or else no survivors would emerge at all. Either way, the bitter sweetness was so intense, anyone wearing rauk, like Mr. Shedd, must be crazy or a masochist. He felt a touch on his arm. Danil motioned. Time to make a polite exit before the rituals resumed. They had work, provisions, and weapons to prepare, as well as the legacy they were to take over the mountains. This morning, Lena Strong had returned from the glade with another young woman Dwyer recognized with a wince. Jennin, one of the big, strapping Worley sisters, along with five donkey loads of books, seeds, and ominous sealed tubes. He had been expecting Reddy as well, but Lena reported that the sages wanted to talk to the Sooner girl for a while longer. No matter. With or without her as a guide, Dwyer was ultimately responsible for getting the small expedition to its goal. And once there, would there be violence, death, or a brave beginning? Sighing, Dwyer turned to follow Ozawa. Now we'll never know if Sarah would have turned out to be right, or Lark, whether the six were bound on the low road or the high.
From here on, it's all about survival.
Behind him, Mr. Shedd pressed both hands against the warped pane, his voice hoarse with anguish over small lives that were not his to adore, or rightfully to mourn. The Stranger.
He wonders how he knows the thing he knows. It used to be so easy, back when wisdom came in compact packages called words. Each one carried a range of meanings, subtly shaded and complex. Strung together, they conveyed a multitude of concepts, plans, emotions, and lies. He blinks as that one word comes slickly into mind, the way so many used to. He whirls it around his tongue, recognizing both sound and meaning at the same time. And this brings on a wash of joy mixed with awe. Awe to imagine that he once did the same thing countless times during the span of any breath, knowing and using innumerable words. He relishes this one, repeating it over and over. Lies. 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 And the miracle redoubles as another related word slips in. Liars. Liars. On his lap he sees the crumpled sketch, now smoothed almost flat again, a detailed rendition of human figures with expressive faces, staring disdainfully past a multi-race crowd of primitive beings. The newcomers wear uniforms with bright emblems he finds somehow familiar. He used to know a name for people like this, a name, and reasons to avoid them. So why had he been so eager to go see them just a little while ago? Why so insistent? At the time, it seemed as if something welled up from deep inside him, an urgency, a need to travel, whatever the cost, to the far-off mountain glen shown in the drawing, to go confront those depicted on a rumpled sheet of off-white paper. The journey had seemed terribly important, though right now he cannot quite remember why. A cloudy haze covers most of his memory, things that had waxed vivid during his delirium now can barely be glimpsed as fleeting images. Like a star that appears dwarfed by a surrounding structure, a made thing consisting of countless angles and divided ledges, enclosing a reddish sun's brittle heat within a maze of plain surfaces. Or a world of water where metal isles just like mushrooms and the sea is a slow poison to touch. Or one particular shallow place in space, far from the deep oases where life normally gathers. Nothing lives in that shoal far beyond the shining spiral arm. Yet amid the strange flatness there, clusters of vast formation of globe-like forms, strangely bright, floating timelessly, resembling a fleet of moons. His mind flees from that last impression, reburying it with all the other half-real memories, losing it along with his past and almost certainly his future. Part 13. The Book of the Sea. Sapient beings are frequently tempted to believe in purpose, that they exist in the universe for a reason, to serve something greater, a race or clan, patrons or gods, or an aesthetic aim, or else to seek individual goals, wealth and power, reproduction, or enhancement of a personal soul.
deep philosophers call this search for purpose nothing more than vanity, a frantic need to justify an inherited drive to exist. But why would our ancestors have brought us here, so far from race, clan, patrons, gods, or wealth or power, if not to serve a purpose higher than all those things? The Scroll of Contemplation. Alvin's Tale.
I always thought of myself as a city boy. After all, Wufan is the biggest port in the south, with almost 1,000 souls, if you include nearby farmers and gleaners. I grew up around docks, warehouses, and cargo hoists. Still, the deploying derrick is really something. A long, graceful shape made of hundreds of tubes of reamed and cured boo. It was pieced together in a matter of days, crisscrossed and joined by a team of Cowan carpenters who listened politely each time O'Donnell berated them for straying from the design illustrated on page 512 of her precious text, Pre-Contact Terran Machinery, Part 8, Heavy Lifting Without Gravitics. Then, with a respectful spin of their cupolas, the Cowans went back to lacing and gluing the crane in their own way, applying lessons learned in real life. O'Donnell should be more flexible, I thought, watching Uriel's humorless assistant grow ever more frustrated. True, the books hold great wisdom, but these guys aren't exactly working with titanium here. We're castaways who must adapt to the times. I was glad to see our pal, Urron, seem satisfied with the work so far, after peering and sniffing at every brace, strut, and pulley. Still, I'd rather Uriel were here, supervising, as she had for the last 2 days, when our group set up camp under the stark shadow of Terminus Rock. The Master Smith was a persnickety, demanding taskmistress, often insisting a job be done over and over again till it was damn well perfect. I guess we four might resent the bossy way she took over what used to be our own private project, but we didn't, or not much. Her attention to detail was nerve-wracking, but each time Uriel finally admitted something was done right, my confidence rose a notch that we might actually come back alive. It came as a blow when she went away. An Irish courier had raced into camp, breathless, exhausted, even thirsty for Ifni's sake, holding an envelope for Uriel to snatch and tear open. On reading the message, she drew aside Teug, the Treiki, and whispered urgently. Then she galloped off, hurrying back toward her precious forge. Since then, things didn't exactly fall apart. The plan moves ahead step by step. But I can't say our mood's quite the same, especially after our first test dive near to drown the passenger. By then, the crane was a beautiful thing, a vaulting arm so graceful you'd never guess, 16 steel bolts thick as my wrist anchored it to the ledge, hanging far over the deep blue waters of the rift. A big drum carried more than 30 cables of Uriel's best hawser, all of it ending in our gray-brown vessel, which we named Wufan's Dream, in hope of placating our parents and those of the local community who think we're doing blasphemy. Another derrick stands alongside the first, linked to an even bigger drum. This one doesn't have to carry the Bathy's weight, but its job is just as vital, keeping a tangle-free length of double hose attached to our little craft, so that clean air goes in and bad air goes out. I never got a chance to ask what the hoses are made of, but it's much stronger than the stitched skink bladders we four had planned using back when we started thinking about this adventure. Uriel had made other changes, a big pressure regulator, high-strain gaskets, and a pair of Ike lights to cast bright beams down where sunshine never reaches. Again, I wondered, Where did all this stuff come from?
It surprised us that Uriel never messed much with the Bathy itself, carved from a single hollowed-out Garu trunk, with Uron's beautiful window sealed at one end. In front, we installed two hinged grabber arms that Uron copied out of a book. Our little craft also bore wheels, four in all, mounted so Wufan's dream might roll along the muddy sea bottom. Even after being fitted with super-wide treads, the wheels looked familiar, especially the Hawk. She had kept them as private mementos out of the wreckage of her home, back when her real Gekek parents were killed in that awful avalanche. With typical grim humor, Huck named them Auntie Reuben, Uncle Jovoon Left, and Uncle Jovoon Right. The fourth one was simply Dad, till I made her stop the grisly joke and call them 1 through 4 instead. Using wheels would normally be impossible without galactic technology. A turning axle would tear any gasket apart. But Huck's macabre stash of spare parts offered a solution. Those wondrous Gekek magnetic hubs and motivator spindles can be placed on either side of the hull without actually piercing the wood. Huck will steer the forward pair of wheels, while I'll use a rotary crank to power the driver pair and back, which covers all our jobs during a dive except Captain Pincertip, whose world of bright blue water we'll pass through on our way to depths no Kellen has seen since their sneak ship sank 1,000 years ago. His place is right in the bubble nose, controlling the Ike lamps and shouting instructions how the rest of us are to steer and push or grab samples. Why does he get to be in charge? Pincer surely never impressed anyone as the brightest member of our gang. First, all this was his idea from the start. He hand, or rather mouth, carved most of the dream all by himself during scarce free time between school and day work in the crustacean pens. More important, if that beautiful window ever starts to fail, or any of the other gaskets, he's the one least likely to panic when salt water starts spraying about the cabin. If that ever happens, it'll be up to Pincer to get the rest of us out somehow. We've all read enough sea and space tales to know that's a pretty good definition of a captain, the one you all better listen to when seconds count the difference between life and death. He'd have to wait a while, though, before taking command. Our first test dive would have just one passenger, a volunteer who was literally born for the job. That morning, Tugh, the Traiki, laid a trail of scentamones to draw the little partial stack, Ziz, from its pen to where Wufan's dream waited, gleaming in the sunshine. Our good ship's hull of polished Garu wood was so bright and lovely. Too bad the open blue sky is normally taken as a bad omen. So it seemed to the onlookers watching our crew from a nearby bluff. There were Hoon from Wufan Port, plus some local Reds, and Urs with caravan dust on their flanks, as well as 3 humans who must have come a hard 3-day trek from the Vale, all of them with nothing better to do than trade hearsay about the starship, or ships, said to have landed up north. One rumor said everyone at the Glade was already dead, executed on the spot by vengeful galactic judges. Another claimed the Holy Egg had wakened fully at last, and the lights some saw in the sky were the souls of those lucky enough to be at gathering when the righteous of the 6 were transformed and sent back as spirits to their ancient homes among the stars. Shave my legs if some of the stories weren't beautiful enough to make me wish I'd made 'em up. Not all the onlookers were protesters. Some came out of curiosity. Huck and I had some fun with Hoer Fuo, who is second nephew by adoption to the mayor's junior half-mother, but who dropped out of school anyway, on account of he claimed not to like the way Mr. Hines smells. But everyone knows Hoerfuo is lazy, and anyway, he shouldn't talk about the hygienic habits of others. At one point, Hoer slinked up to ask about the dream and its mission. Nice, polite questions, mind you, but he seemed to barely hear our answers. Then he sort of eased over to asking questions about Traeges, gesturing over at Tuge, who was feeding Ziz in Ur's pen. True, we have a pharmacist in Wufan Town, but still there's some mystery about the Ringed Ones. Sure enough, Huck and I soon got the gist of what Hoerfuo was going on about. He and some of his backwash friends had a wager going about Traeke's sex life, and he'd been elected to run the matter past us as local experts. Sharing a wink, Huck and I quickly emptied his head of all the nonsense it had been stuffed with, then proceeded to fill it back up with our own imaginative version. Hoer soon looked like a sailor who had just had a loose tackle pulley carry him off his skull. Glancing furtively at his feet, he hurried off, no doubt to check for ring spores, lest he start growing little traeches in places where he'd been neglectful about washing. I don't feel much guilt over it. Anyone standing downwind from Hoerfuo from now on ought to thank us. I was going to ask Huck if we were ever that dumb. Then I recalled. Didn't she once convince me that a Gekek can manage to be her own mother and father? I swear, she had made it sound plausible at the time, though for the life of me, I still can't figure out how. For the first couple of days, the spectators mostly lurked beyond a line in the sand, drawn by Uriel with her sage's baton. No one said much while the Master Smith was around. But after she left, some took to yelling slogans, mostly objecting that the midden is sacred, not a place for conceited gloss addicts to go sightseeing. Once the Veil humans arrived, the protests got better organized, with banners and slogans chanted in unison. I found it pretty exciting, like a scene from Summer of Love or Things to Come, all full of righteous dissent for a cause. To a hummocker like me, nothing could be more buff than forging ahead with an adventure against popular opinion. Seems nearly all the romantic tales I've read were about intrepid heroes persisting despite the doubts of stick-in-the-mud parents, neighbors, or authority figures. It reminded me of the book my nickname comes from, where the people of Diaspar try to keep Alvin from making contact with their long-lost cousins in faraway Lys, or when the Lysians don't want him going back home with news of their rediscovered world. Yeah, I know, that's fiction, but the connection stoked my resolve. Huck and Urron and Pincertip said they all felt the same. As for the mob, well, I know that folks who are scared can get unreasonable. I even tried once or twice to see it from their point of view. Really, I did. Boy, what a bloat torus of jeeky, ifny-slucking skirls. Hope they all sit on bad mulch and get spin vapors.
Part 14. The Book of the Slope. Legends. It is said that humans on Earth spent untold generations living in brute fear, believing a myriad of things that no sensible person would ever imagine. Certainly not anyone who had been handed truth on a silver platter, the way it was given to nearly every sapient race in the five galaxies. Earthlings had to figure it all out for themselves. Slowly, agonizingly, humans learned how the universe worked, abandoning most of the fanciful beliefs they carried through their long, dark loneliness. This included belief in the divine right of egotistical kings, the mental incapacity of women, the idea that a wise state knows all, the idea that the individual is always right, the sick, sweet addiction that transforms a doctrine from a mere model of the world into something sacred, worth killing for. These and many other wild concepts eventually joined pixies and UFOs in the trunk where humans finally put away such childish things. A very large trunk. Even so, the newly contacted Galactics saw Earthlings as superstitious primitives, as wolflings, prone to weird enthusiasms and peculiar, unprovable convictions. How ironic, then, is the role reversal that we see on Gijo, where Earthlings found the other five far regressed down a road humans had traveled before, wallowing in a myriad of fables, fantasies, grudges, and vividly absurd notions. To this maelstrom of superstition, settlers fresh off the tabernacle contributed more than paper books. They also brought tools of logic and verification, the very things Earthlings had to fight hardest to learn back home. Moreover, with their own history in mind, Earthlings became voracious collectors of folklore, fanning out among the other five to copy down every tale, every belief, even those they demonstrated to be false. Out of their wolfling past came this strange mixture, reasoning skepticism, plus a deep appreciation of the peculiar, the bizarre, the extravagantly vivid. Amid the darkness, humans know that it is all too easy to lose your way if you forget how to tell what is true. But it is just as urgent never to let go of the capacity to dream, to weave the illusions that help us all make it through this dark, dark night. From The Art of Exile by Aufhu Fwabhu. Asks. The tiny robot was a wonder to behold. No larger than a Gekek's eyeball, it lay pinned down to the ground by a horde of attacking privacy wasps, covered by their crowded, fluttering wings. Lester was the first sage to comment after the initial surprise.
"Well, now we know why they're called privacy wasps. Did you see the way they swarmed over that thing? Otherwise, we'd never have known it was there."
"A device for spying. Surmise, knife-bright insight, tipping her carapace to get a closer look at the machine. Minuscule and mobile, sent to listen in on our council. We would have been helpless, all our plans revealed, if not for the wasps." Fahundao concurred with a deep, humble
room. "We are used to seeing the insects as minor irritants, their presence required by tradition for certain ceremonies. But the Booyer must have designed the wasps for just such a purpose, to patrol their cities and homes, thwarting would-be eavesdroppers."
"Using a specifically designed life form to deal with the annoying threat. Indeed, that would have been the Booyer way." Added Urja. Lester leaned close to peer at the wasps, whose wings rippled in front of the robot's tiny eyes, beating a maze of colors that reminded me, us, of Rauk.
I wonder what the wasps are showing it, murmured our human sage. Then Vubbin spoke for the first time since the wasps attacked the intruder. Probably exactly what it wants to see, he suggested confidently. Do you recall my rings, how we all nodded, sighed, or humbled respectful agreement? Vubbin spoke the words so well, in such tones of wise credibility. Only later did it occur to we, us, to ask ourselves, what? What in the world could he possibly mean by that?
Lark. During 2,000 years of illicit settlement, Lark was hardly the first member of the Six to fly. He wasn't even the first human. Soon after the sneak ship Tabernacle sank forever into the Midden's sucking embrace, men and women used to soar like kites, riding steady offshore winds from the blue ocean all the way to the white peaks of the Rimmer Range. Back in those days, lacy airfoils used to catch sky currents, lofting brave pilots to survey their new world from above. The last silky glider now lay under glass in a Byblos museum, a wonder to behold, made of the mystical materials monomolecular carbon and woven stress polymer, which the brightest wizards of the Chemists Guild could not reproduce today, even if the sages allowed it. Time and mishaps eventually smashed all the others, leaving later human generations to walk the heavy ground like everybody else, and erasing one more cause of jealousy among the Six. Though lately, since the Great Peace, groups of ambitious youths had resumed a crude version of the pastime, occasionally risking their lives on spindly frames of hollow boo covered with hand-woven sheets of wick cotton. Or else Urish middlings rode bulging balloons, wafting upward on puffs of torrid air. Sometimes success caused a local sensation, but none of the efforts had much lasting effect. Available materials were too heavy, weak, or porous. The wind was much too strong. Some, with ardent piety, claimed this was a good thing. The sky was not where redemption would be found, nor in clinging to vanities of the past. Lark normally agreed with the orthodox view, but in this case he mused, such a modest dream. To waft a few leagues through the lower air, was that so much to ask when one had the stars? He was never one to waste time on idle fancies, though. Certainly Lark never expected, personally, to spy down on Jijo's mountains from a great height. But look at me now! Ling had clearly enjoyed watching his expression when she told him of today's plan. We'll be gone most of the day to pick up some specimens our robots have snared. Later, as the drones roam farther afield, we'll go for trips of several days at a time. Lark had stared at the alien flying machine, a slender arrow with stubby wings that unfolded after it exited a narrow tunnel from the buried research station. The hatch gaped like a pair of hungry jaws. How like Ling to spring this on him without warning? While Besh loaded supplies, the big blonde man, Kun, shouted,
"Come on, Ling, we're running late. Coax your pet aboard or get another."
Lark set his jaw, determined to show no emotion as he followed her up a ramp. He expected a cave-like interior, but it turned out to be more brightly lit than any enclosed space he'd ever seen.
There was no need to let his eyes adapt. Not wanting to gawk like a yokel, he aimed for a padded seat next to a window and dropped his pack nearby. Lark sat down gingerly, finding the voluptuous softness neither comfortable nor comforting. It felt as if he had settled onto the lap of something fleshy and perhaps queerly amorous. Moments later, Ling added to his unease by strapping a belt across his waist. The hissing closure of the metal hatch made his ears feel funny, increasing his disorientation. The moment the engines came on, Lark felt a strange tickling at the base of his neck, as if a small animal were breathing on the hairs back there. He could not help lifting a hand to brush away at the imaginary creature. Takeoff was surprisingly gentle, a wafting motion, rising and turning. Then the skyboat swept away so quickly that he had no chance to survey the glade and its surroundings, or to seek the hidden valley of the egg. By the time he turned around to press close against the window, the continent was already sweeping underneath as they hurtled southward, many times faster than a catapulted stone. Only minutes later, they dropped away from the alpine hills, streaking over a wide-open plain of steppe grass, which bowed and rippled like the ever-changing surface of a phosphorescent sea. At one point, Lark spotted a drove of galloping stem chompers, a genus of native Jijoan ungulates, which trumpeted distress and reared away from the airboat's passing shadow. A band of Urish herders stretched their sinuous necks in expressions of curiosity mixed with dread. Near the adults, a group of early middlings gambled and snapped in mock battle, ignoring their elders' sudden dark focus on the heavens.
"Your enemies certainly are graceful creatures," Ling commented.
Lark turned and stared at her.
"What's she going on about now?"
Ling must have misinterpreted his look, hurrying as if to placate. "Of course I mean that, in a strictly limited sense, the way a horse or other animal can be graceful."
Lark pondered before answering.
It's too bad your visit disrupted gathering. We'd normally be having the games about now. That's when you'd see real grace in action."
"Games? Oh, yes, your version of the fabled Olympics. Lots of running and jumping around, I suppose?"
He nodded guardedly.
"There are speed and agility events. Others let our best and bravest test their endurance, courage, adaptability.
All traits highly prized by those who brought humanity into being," Ling said. Her smile was indulgent, faintly condescending. "I don't imagine any of the six species go up against each other directly in any events, do they? I mean, it's hard to picture a Kek outrunning an Urz, or a Cowan doing a pole vault."
She laughed.
Lark shrugged. Despite Ling's hint regarding a subject of great moment, the question of human origins, he found himself losing interest in the conversation.
"Yes, I suppose it could be hard to picture."
He turned to look back out the window, watching the great plains sweep by, wave after wave of bending grass, punctuated by stands of dark boo or oases of gently swaying trees. A distance requiring several days to cross by caravan was dismissed in a few brief duras of blithe flight. Then the smoldering mountains of the southern range swarmed into view. Besh, the forayer pilot, banked the craft to get a closer look at Blaze Mountain, circling at an angle so that Lark's window stared vertiginously on a vast lava apron where past eruption layers spilled across a country that was both ravaged and starkly renewed. For an instant, he glimpsed the smelters that lay clustered halfway up the mighty eminence. Fashioned to resemble native magma tubes and flows, the forge vented steam and smoke, no different from that exhaled by nearby wild apertures. Of course, the camouflage was never meant to endure scrutiny as close as this. Lark saw Besh share a knowing glance with Kun, who tapped one of his magical viewing screens. Out of several score glowing red lights outlining the mountain's shape, one was marked by sharp symbols and glowing arrows. Dotted lines traced underground passages and workrooms where famed Urish smiths labored to make tools out of those special alloys sanctioned by the sages, second in quality only to those produced farther south, near the peak of towering Mount Gwen.
Incredible, Lark thought, trying to memorize the level of detail shown on Kun's screen for his report to Lester Campbell. Clearly that monitor had little to do with the ostensible purpose of this mission, scouting for advanced, candidate life forms. From a few brief exchanges, Lark reckoned Kun was no biologist. Something in the man's stance, his way of moving, reminded one of Dwur stalking through a forest, only more deadly. Even after generations of relative tranquility, a few men and women on the slope still carried themselves like that, experts whose chief job was to circulate each summer from village to village, training local human militias. Just in case. Each of the other five races had similar specialists. A prudent policy, since even now there were regular minor crises. A criminal act here, a wayward tribe of Sooners there, and spates of hot-tempered friction between settlements. Enough to make peacetime warrior, no contradiction in terms. The same might also be true of Kun. Looking lethally competent didn't mean he was coiled, preparing to wreak murder. "What's your purpose, Kun?" Lark wondered, watching symbols flash across the screen, crisscrossing reflections of the outlander's face. "What exactly are you looking for?" Blaze Mountain fell behind them, as the little vessel now seemed to leap ahead at a new angle, spearing across a brilliant whiteness known as the Plain of Sharp Sand. For a long time, low dunes swept past, undulating in windswept perfection. Lark saw no caravans laboring across the sparkling desert, carrying mail or trade goods to isolated settlements of the Vale. But then, no one sane ranged those searing wastes by day. There were hidden shelters down there where travelers awaited nightfall, which even Kun's rays shouldn't be able to pick out amid the glaring immensity. That pale dazzle was nothing compared to the next sudden transition, crossing over from the sand ocean to the spectral flow, a blurry expanse of shifting colors that made Lark's eyes sting. Ling and Besh tried to peer at it past their sheltering hands before finally giving up, while Kun muttered sourly at the static on his display. Lark struggled against a natural reflex to squint, endeavoring instead to loosen his habitual way of focusing. Dwur had once explained that it was the only way to let oneself see in this realm where exotic crystals cast an ever-changing wildness of luminance. That had been shortly after Dwur won Master Hunter status, when he returned home to join Lark and Sarah at their mother's bedside during the illness that finally took her away, turning Nello almost overnight into an old man. Melina accepted no food during that final week, and very little drink. Of her two eldest, whose minds she had doted on day in, day out, ever since arriving in Dolo to be a papermaker's wife, she now seemed to need nothing.
but from her youngest child she devoured tales of his wanderings, the sights, sounds, and sensations of far corners of the slope, where few ever trod. Lark recalled feeling a jealous pang when he saw the contentment Dwyer's stories gave in her last hours, then chiding himself for having such unworthy thoughts. That memory swept over him starkly, apparently triggered by the stabbing colors. Some credulous folk among the six said these layers of poisoned stone had magical properties, poured into them by eons of overlapping volcanic effusions. Mother Gijo's blood, they called it. At that moment,